7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
I guess it's you and I today.
Indeed. It looks like you're still on the road from when we last recorded a show.
Yeah, this was going to be a six-week road trip for me.
Oh, my gosh.
And then as I go back just for a couple of days, and I go away again for another 2, maybe 3 weeks, go back again for a week, and then back on the road again for another couple of weeks.
And as a dedicated member of the Flight Safety Detectives, you're recording on the road, at home, wherever the opportunity presents itself, and our members appreciate that.
Well, we try to spread the word. So today, what I thought, since we've had a lot of junior accident investigators get all over the YouTube and all the channels for the UPS accident, you know, calling out all sorts of things. We have one notable airline captain who has been telling the world that UPS number 2 engine was spotted, and the NTSB has set that aside, that was not spotted. Spotted as foreign object ingestion or digestion. Or anyway, it means pieces of something went in the engine and caused deterioration of the engine, and the NTSB has said that didn't happen. So anyway, I don't want to talk about the UPS event. I would just like to talk about the pain and suffering it causes everybody when we have so-called knowledgeable people spewing speculation and the effect it has on accident investigation and also the families.
That sort of thing you talked about is not just a 2026 problem. This was a problem even before the internet became the go-to place for people to set their opinions out there. And we're going back in time to 2003, in fact, January 8th, 2003. There was an accident in Charlotte, North Carolina, involving a Beech 1900, a twin-engine commuter-size aircraft that crashed shortly after takeoff. And as we were discussing before we came on the show, you were the lead investigator in that. And by the time you got there, the local news channels and other news organizations had reached out and talked to a bunch of experts who had already put their ideas of what happened out there. And in addition, and this I find kind of shocking, you actually had a situation where the airline, which is normally a party to the investigation, was out there putting their own spin on the subject, even though that's just not the way things are done. So take us through that for a minute.
After we got there, the airplane was burned quite very much so burned because it took off with fuel. It crashed on the airport. It actually crashed in the parking area for the US Air hangar down there. So it was not a US Air airplane, although it was operating on a code share with US Air. So had it been a US Air airplane, I would not have been able to go in that accident because I was prohibited because I had worked for US Air. So, but anyway, it didn't fall into that area that I could not participate. And so we did. We showed up in the morning. The airplane had flown a number of flights since it last left maintenance. And what had happened is the airplane was finally loaded and it was a little bit tail heavy. And when the airplane took off, because it was improperly rigged in maintenance, the ability to push the nose over was inhibited. So tail heavy, pull the nose up, put your tail down. And to counter that, you would have flight control authority that allowed the pilot to push the nose over. Because the airplane was misrigged in maintenance, that the pilot didn't have enough command authority to push the nose over, the airplane stalled and crashed.
Now,
And
there's a
so,
lot to unpack here, starting with the fact that this aircraft, the Beech 1900, was first certified in 1967 with piston engines. And later on, it was upgraded with turboprop engines, which are much more powerful. Yet, as you were telling me, because of the desire for the company not to recertify this as an entirely new aircraft, they made changes to the engines, but didn't make any changes to the flight control system. And how is that possibly a problem when you go from piston to turboprop?
well, first off, you've increased the horsepower considerably, but that's not really a problem. That can be a benefit. In this case, I think it was. The airframe itself had proven itself to be a very reliable airframe. So the desire to upgrade the power to keep it in service longer was probably a solid decision. When they did that, and to minimize the cost of recertifying the airplane with the new engines, they just kept it to the new engines and kept the original flight controls. As a result, the airplane had more control than it really needed. It had a tremendous amount of control. And so over time, in the locations where this airplane had been working, for example, in Alaska, it was as we discovered as part of the investigation, but it was not part of the investigation, if you know what I mean. As we started to look at other operators and what was going on with the airplane, we found out that in many places it was common to overload the tail. By overload, I mean the tail may have a load limit of, say, 1,500 pounds, but it was not uncommon to find operators putting 2,000 pounds in the tail. Because the airplane had so much flight control authority, it could hold that extra weight in the tail and keep the nose level. Maybe not 100% legal, but it was pretty common in remote locations, not in commercial aviation.
They would have the control authority to keep the nose level. However, the issue with this particular crash was that they didn't have full authority. And the reasons behind that, it might be kind of surprising, but as we were discussing before, the overall situation of how the maintenance was done and how it was managed is fairly common around the world even today.
Well, that is true. In remote locations around the world, there are some places where these same kinds of procedures take place today. You might have a whole bunch of people that have some mechanical experience, even on airplanes, but they really have only one or two people that are guiding them through all the process. In this case, we have a small crew of people, six or seven, I forget the number of people on a crew. Only one of which was really very experienced on the airplane. We had another mechanic that had some years in the business, not a lot. And then we had four or five people that were relatively brand new mechanics. So we had really a big burden on the one person that was very experienced on this airplane, guiding the maintenance that night. And he happened to be the inspector, so he had to wear his own job as an inspector, but he also had to wear the hat of the supervisor and also the trainer. So he was quite busy trying to guide all these half a dozen people to do their jobs. And the person who had this job of checking the rigging on the airplane had some experience before, but not on this airplane. And the inspector was trying to guide him to do the rigging check while he was doing the same thing with other mechanics. There was a heavier engine inspection, and I forget all the other details, but he was quite busy. And the person who had the rigging did it improperly. So now the airplane had left, but the flight controls were not rigged exactly the same as they came in. The authority of the pilot to push the nose over had been diminished in the rigging. So the pilot could pull the nose way up, but had the inability to push the nose over as far as needed. Now, the airplane had flown several flights like that. It wasn't until a full airplane with a full load of bags in the rear cargo compartment, in the tail, that shifted the center of gravity of the airplane aft, requiring more nose-down attitude on takeoff. On takeoff, because of the extra weight, the airplane, the nose started to climb very rapidly towards the sky, and the pilot had limited ability to push it over. The airplane stalled right over the airport, crashed and burned, and everybody perished. So that was the scene that, of the accident. Now, the day before when the accident happened, all we at the NTSB knew was we had a plane crash on takeoff. And from what we had from visuals and from people that experienced was that it appeared the airplane had stalled. We didn't have any clue why. So we mounted in Washington, we mount the full investigative crew, and we pack up and we leave for Charlotte first thing in the morning.
So the accident happened around 9 in the morning on the 8th, basically 24 hours later. You and the crew and your team were heading over there.
No, so we left right after the accident. You know, the GO team is about an hour. I misspoke a minute ago. So we left right in the morning. It's only less than an hour. And we flew in the government airplane, so we didn't have to worry about the schedules. So we showed up at the airport within an hour, and away we went. And when we got there, we're getting our act together. We're over at the scene looking at it, and we have no idea what's going on the news media. It was only in the early afternoon when I was preparing to give the first briefing that our public affairs people, the NTSB's public affairs people, came to me and told me that we have a real media frenzy going on. It seems that all the big channels had managed to get themselves probably in competition with one another, so-called experts on, and they were having a field day with this accident because there was nothing out of the NTSB yet, and they were just spewing speculation every which way. And in order to protect themselves, the airline was responding to it. We haven't had our first meeting yet. So, and the airline was going. My public affairs people were all over me to curtail the airline from speaking out. And I chose not to, because there was so much inaccurate information being put out there that I felt that the airline needed to defend themselves.
Let me set the stage here a bit. The event, the crash, happened around 8:47 in the morning, East Coast time, which from my past experience dealing with the media and also running my website, there are certain times of the day where if an accident happens, it almost guarantees tremendous amounts of coverage. This is one of those times. 9 o'clock in the morning is after the morning newspapers have been delivered, so TV media is going to be the main way that people get information about this. So if these people jump right on board, they're guaranteed to have a lot of footage for the afternoon and evening newscast. And it's still late afternoon over in Europe, so you have a situation where all of North America and all of Western Europe might have live television coverage riveted to this accident.
No question. No question. Of course, all of us on the teams, we didn't know any of this was going on, because we're at the site. It wasn't until I came back to do an afternoon briefing. And normally we do them at 12. I don't know that it was 12 that day, because we would have been just there maybe at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock or so. And I think we were still trying to get our bearings going and on where we were going with this and what we needed to do. So in any event, whenever it is I made it to go talk to the press, and the wall of cameras, if you will, it had a lot of media attention, and I wasn't aware that they all had talking heads, experts, spewing speculation like crazy. It was only when I got to our public affairs people that they told me briefly that this was going on. I had no idea the width and breadth of it. All right, so we did the stand-up, as we call it, where I explained it, where we are, what we knew for facts, and what our next actions were going to be. And then when we broke away from those cameras, I went off and I looked to see what had been going on. And it was really amazing how much misinformation, how much baloney, I'll use a politically correct word, that was going on around this accident. I mean, it was really all over the place.
Without naming names, without pointing anyone out in particular, this was 2003, 23 years ago. Are any of the people who were spewing baloney still prominent in as an on-air expert? That's just my general question. That's a yes/no answer.
I don't know. I'd have to
There you
go
go.
back and look at all that myself. I mean, it was 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. I don't remember.
Here's my editorial comment. They may or may not be active now, but trust me, there are many, many, many more people, some of whom are quite good at this, who are giving their opinions as on-air experts, either with media channels or with their own social media channels. And some of them are quite good, some of them are okay, and some of them, let's just say that they're not in our we're not there in their fan club.
You know, they're just running at the mouth. I mean, we go to great lengths on our show to talk about facts. And when we speculate, we make it clear that we're speculating. But what happens on many of these other programs is they don't say they're speculating. They say and portray it as something that they know. And any of the ex-NTSB people you will see are normally very guarded in what they say around the facts of the accident. If it hasn't been put out by the NTSB, then they don't want to step onto those landmines because it destroys your credibility. But in this case, there was a number of them that were talking to multiple stations, and they were just speculating like crazy, portraying it like it was facts. And the first reaction was from the airline themselves trying to defend themselves. And of course, the NTSB public affairs staff came to me wanting me to curtail them from talking, which is part of our normal rules. But when I saw the width and breadth of what had happened while we were out at the scene, while we weren't paying attention to the press, I made a decision not to curtail it. I let them run. Till much later in the day to defend themselves, and then we cut them off. Later on, and I think it was the next day, when I had the flight data recorder information, raw data, not analyzed. I'll tell the audience, when you have raw data, because it's hasn't been lined up with times. You know, the clock is important, what happened when, and making sure that the engine, for example, the engine parameters start at the right time, right? So the flight data recorder just records a whole bunch of information. You have to put it in order. You have to have a good starting point, which is the time, and you have to make sure that everything is lined up. The data that I had in the very beginning did not have all that lineup. I had just raw data, but it was enough to make some determinations on what we needed to do. So now I'm faced with a dilemma on the evening. I had just before the evening session, before the cameras, I had contacted the company's representative and asked them to curtail their conversations. And then on an evening briefing that I got on, I actually gave out the raw data information, which is something very unusual. In fact, I get a phone call from Washington criticizing me for doing that. Yep. I had a big problem down there, not in Washington. I needed to deal with the speculation. I needed to curtail it because it was not only affecting the company's position, it was filtering into our investigators. They're bugging me, what the heck is going on? What's going on? What, you know, is this affect, you know, do we need to go do some of the things that these guys were speculating about? So it was disrupting our workflow in the investigation. And then I was also dealing with what was left of the families that were showing up because of their loved ones that were on the airplane. And of course, they were watching the news, looking for every bit of information they could get. And now they were all off on tangents on us. Why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? So faced with that, I had very limited options. So I chose the one, let's put the correct information out there as we know it.
And before we go further, I'd like to refer back to a program we did a couple months ago with Linda Tabin, who is an expert in risk communications. But before I talk about that program and why those who are interested should look at that, let me talk to the folks who have joined the Flight Safety Detectives, our members. We thank you very much for doing so, and we're hoping that you are enjoying your membership and the benefits that come with that, including getting early access to new episodes and other goodies to be determined later. And if you're interested in becoming a member, you'll see a graphic on the screen with an arrow pointing to the join button on the YouTube channel. Join, do what is necessary to become a member at whatever level you'd like, and enjoy those benefits. And if you have questions, whether or not you're a member or not, write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we're not leaving out sponsors. We love sponsors. We can always use more, and we hope that you can use our content to attract our audience to your product or service. Contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll have a conversation. Now, getting back to our episode with Linda Tabin, she's a risk communication specialist. She talked extensively in that episode about how she trained many airlines to deal with a situation like this. You have all these questions coming at you, and there are good ways and not so good ways to approach it. In this case, like I said earlier about the timing, it was at the time of day where this was going to guarantee a lot of heavy media attention, and the airline was doing what they could. In a situation like that, and I'm not a corporate communications expert, but if you have the lights in your face and they're being asked questions, fairly pointed questions, you have to have a response. They're good ones and they're bad ones. In your case, with the case with this airline, do you think the airline, given the situation, were they doing a decent job at quelling the riot of media in front of them?
No, the airline, I think, was playing catch up because the news media had a head start on them because it was senior management of the airline who had also flown in early afternoon and was also caught in the same firestorm. And the local people were responding from the airline, trying to quell all the speculation or answer the questions. I'm not even sure they identified it as speculation, but they were trying to answer all the questions when the senior management showed up on their own airplane. They took over the role of trying to quell it, but it really they were behind the curve, so they were trying to play catch up.
But once you were on the scene and started giving your own press briefings, they had, I wouldn't say they had cover, but they had to shift their role as to having the NTSB being the point of contact for any media contact, and they could just defer questions to you.
Right. But that wasn't happening. They were defending themselves, and I decided to let that run for a little while, maybe for two reasons. One, I thought they had the right to defend themselves against all this inaccuracy. But secondly, I didn't have all the accurate information myself to step in and put it down with pure facts, not just don't do it. So I let it run for a little while, and then I finally, through their representatives, as we started to put the groups together, asked them to curtail their responses, and I'll take over. in which they did. They just stopped talking and they referred everything to me. So the press, the focus of the press turned to the NTSB and to me. So at that point, I had to be the buffer between the press with their so-called experts spewing their poison and the families, the NTSB staff, and the effect of all the, what the press was doing on our investigation. So it was unusual. I mean, I by that point in time, I had done a fairly large number of investigations, not counting all the ones I did before I came to the NTSB, because I did I was involved with quite a few before my appointment to the NTSB. So I knew the system, I knew it worked, and it was clearly derailed at this point. So now my job was as the chief spokesman of the investigation is to try to get it back on track. So that's when I stopped the airline from defending it, and I started putting the NTSB's hat on and starting to control the flow of information out. And with all the speculation, that, and I forget how many of these so-called experts there were, but there was quite a few. I needed to have the most accurate information I could to put down what they were saying.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
This event happened in January of 2003, less than a year and a half after 9/11. How much of the noise that was being put out were speculations about this being a sabotage or a terrorist event?
A little bit, not a lot, but it was because of 9/11 and the focus on coverage that resulted in this being such a big event. So prior to 9/11, some of these commuter crashes and a number of other kinds of crashes did not get the media attention that 9/11 and its aftermath resulted in. Right, so maybe the press realized that after 9/11 that they had a economic tiger by the tail, because it drove all kinds of viewership and all kinds of readership for the newspapers.
The Charlotte Observer was probably one of the few papers that were less in speculation than others, but they were dwarfed by the bigger name newspapers. So it was a challenging time, and by putting out the facts that we had in an orderly way, we were able to curtail it. It took another 12 hours to really get it under control. So overnight, there was a lot of conversation. So after that evening briefing, overnight, I mean, I had a lot of discussions with the media that we normally would dealt with about their behavior.
Now, this is my spin on the media's reaction to this. And this is based on me having dealt with the media in one form or another, from being in front of cameras and whatnot, to basically running my website and trying to figure out which events attract more attention. And this event had a lot of things going for it as far as public interest was concerned. One, as I said before, was the timing of it. Two, it was an airline that was very heavily used on the East Coast. And there were a lot of passengers who were also in the media who conceivably could have taken a ride on either this kind of aircraft or with this company. And again, it was Air Midwest, which was flying on behalf of US Air. So US Air was a very popular airline in that part of the country. Compare that to a lot of commuter events that might happen, let's say, in Alaska. You could have many people killed, but it's not necessarily a commuter-sized aircraft that was flying on behalf of a larger airline.
For the most part, events that happen out west don't have as much media attention as those that happen in the eastern part of the U.S.
Well, in the last few months, we had a 7 fatal, I think the number was either 5 or 7 fatal in Alaska. And it, you don't hear about it at all. But this airplane in Charlotte was a lightning rod for all the TV, radio, and pencil press outlets. They were just all there. So it was quite a challenge, I'll tell you. Quite an experience for me, having been through many, many previous investigations that were much more orderly in the beginning. So,
now, I'd like to talk about the aftermath of this, aftermath of the investigation. After it was determined that the maintenance had a very definite part to play in this, as did the overloading of the aircraft, what were the psychological effects that you were aware of those people who were directly involved in this operation, especially the maintenance people at that overnight maintenance they did on this aircraft?
Well, I don't have any direct knowledge, but I was told that several of those mechanics are not working on airplanes anymore by their own changing careers, which is not uncommon, which is not uncommon. We have a commuter crash in Texas where one of the mechanics that was involved would have committed suicide. In fact, a more visible accident, the American Airlines DC-10 crash in Chicago, which had some maintenance responsibility because of an engine change on that airplane. I've been told that one of the person's mechanics involved with that also committed suicide. And there's several others that I know of that in the same boat. And I know a couple of mechanics in a crash in New England that I worked on that voluntarily left the industry. They're not working on airplanes anymore. So mechanics take their jobs very seriously, and it can have all kinds of effects on them. And in these cases, a couple of extreme ones with the suicides, but all the others just leaving the industry and going to the other areas where you work on cars, you don't have the same problem, psychological problem that you have is working on airplanes.
Now, this is a question aimed more at major airlines that have their own internal maintenance departments. Do you think that the larger airlines have done a good job of psychological support for maintenance people and other people who are indirectly or directly involved with an accident?
So for more than, you know, it's approaching 40 years now. I'm thinking 30, 38. Yeah, it's about more than 35 years. The industry has been both proactive and pushed into having care teams for their own employees. You know, the airlines, many of them had teams that would deal with the families that were left behind. And they would sometimes use the Red Cross to help through that process with the grieving families. But nobody 30 years ago, or maybe roughly 30 years ago, ever thought about anything about their own employees, about the friends of people who work on it. Today, that's changed. Today, we have teams available to us at the other end of the phone. Make a call saying you need help, and you're going to get help. You're going to get all kinds of help, psychological, medical, whatever it needs, you're going to get it. So we have grown up, so to speak, to deal with our own employees in the business. But it wasn't always like that. And when this accident happened, it was on the weaker side. It was already in place, but it was on the weaker side than it is today.
Now, I asked the question about airlines that have their own internal maintenance departments for a reason, because a lot of maintenance, even for major airlines in the U.S., major maintenance especially, is done by third parties, sometimes overseas. Do you see that same kind of support for maintenance people who are contractors or subcontractors as opposed to those who are directly related to the airline?
You know, you raise a good question because I don't know the answer to that. Some of the bigger repair stations in the business, I'm sure they do. But there's over 1,000 of those companies that do bits and pieces of an airplane. They don't do the whole airplane. And I don't know that they have that in place. And they may feel like they're a little bit immune because when you fix on a component of an airplane, it goes into a big stock room with a whole bunch of other components of airplanes. And you may never know what airplane it was put on. So it may never come back to you in that way. But you raise a very interesting question. And in fact, I am actually going to be with a group of people in 3 weeks. I'm addressing them, repair stations. And I will ask that question.
And I ask that question because in this case, the accident happened in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the repair shop was in West Virginia, a short flight away, in fact. In fact, the accident crew had flown this same aircraft 6 times the previous day after it got repaired. But if this had been, I'm just pulling a country out of the air here. Let's say you had a repair station in Costa Rica. How difficult would it have been for NTSB investigators in today's environment to go down there and face-to-face have conversations with the people who are involved in that? Or would this all be done remotely?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. That's a whole new area for me. It may already be covered by those operators. I mean, we really, this issue about emotional support for the employees really came about after the Aloha accident in the late 80s, when the pilot who actually saved that airplane from crashing had an emotional breakdown afterwards, and nobody noticed. And somebody finally noticed. But it took, if I remember right, it took about a year before it surfaced.
And just to remind the audience, this was an event, Aloha Airlines 737. All but one person survived. A piece of the roof came off, and a flight attendant was ejected outside the aircraft into the ocean and was never recovered. And there were a lot of serious injuries, but they were able to get the airplane on the ground.
So she did a heck of a job, but she emotionally she paid it. She blamed herself, is what I'm told. I've actually talked to her a couple of times, but I wouldn't talk to her about this. I wouldn't want to raise that again, but she's a really nice person, and she took it to heart. She took it to heart. You know, airline people care about their passengers and their airplanes. That's something that if you said that to me, I would have not said that.
The second to last word here is a little bit different. It's not about the accident itself, because what was important here was not the cause as much as the context. The context of that particular accident and how it's still relevant decades later. The questions that, like you said yourself, about how are maintenance people being dealt with emotionally when something like this happens, especially if it's a contractor or an overseas location. And I hope you do find some answers from your colleagues about that.
As final word, I'll do what I always do. Please, if you're going flying, do a good job of pre-planning. Do it at home. Do it when you're at the airport. A good walk around. Please do a good work walk around. And we're still finding accidents that have a poor walk around as part of the probable cause. And when you're up in the air, put that head on a swivel and make sure that you're paying attention, situational awareness to everything that's going on around you. And a special thanks to all of our supporters in this effort. And hope we'll see you on the next show.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
and be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.